coming up at 4 o'clock. At 3:40 today, arts reporter Julie Burstein speaks with gallery director Marion Locks about her new talent show. With me now on Fresh Air is Barbara Walker, author of the new book, The Women's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets, which approaches the subject of sexism and religion from the historical and mythic viewpoint. In this encyclopedia, she covers many religions, including paganism, Buddhism, Islam, Greek mythology, Christianity, and Judaism. The encyclopedia's entries give the stories behind word origins, customs, legends, and superstitions. Barbara Walker started her research about 25 years ago out of personal curiosity. She eventually decided to convert her copious notes into a book. This work has been a personal passion, but she's not a trained historian. Her previous books are on the subject of knitting. She has a forthcoming book on the subject of tarot cards. Barbara Walker lives in Morristown, New Jersey. Her new book, The Woman's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets, is published by Harper & Row. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. It's nice to be here.
Your background wasn't in history or religion, but you've been pursuing the subject for, well, ever since you've gotten out of college, you told me. Why has it been such a passion for all these years?
I think when I first realized that women were discriminated against in our culture, I wondered really why there was this system and where it began. And I have the feeling that it began with our religious background, our Judeo-Christian background, which is certainly patriarchal.
Are you a religious person yourself?
No, I'm not.
Have your views on religion changed at all in the course of your research?
Actually, I think they have not changed since I was a little girl in Sunday school.
In the Judeo-Christian traditions, God is given a male gender, and at least the words that are used are traditionally he. The gender of the words used to describe God are male. In a history of religion, do you think that gods have traditionally had gender?
Always, I believe. We have encountered in various mythologies gods and goddesses who were combined in one body, in one bisexual body. And there have been homosexual gods among cultures which accepted homosexuality. But by and large, gods and goddesses were always a he or a she. There was never an it that I can recall from any of my studies.
Are there any generalizations you can make about the differences between gods and goddesses in cultures that had both?
The scholars who were my sources for my book pretty much agree that the cultures that worshiped the goddess were much more peace-loving, much less militaristic than the god-worshipping cultures, that they were more egalitarian. They did not lean toward hierarchies and bureaucracies and one group oppressing another group. It seems that the matriarchal or matrilineal cultures did think more about people and about their next generation.
You write that you think that Christianity intentionally buried women's spiritual past. What do you mean by that, and what are some examples?
Well, it says in the Gospels that the great goddess whom all the world worships must be destroyed and her temples must be leveled to the ground. And I think that through the centuries, Christianity really has endeavored to do just that. The early Christians were very much opposed to the priestesses, such as the Vestal Virgins in Rome, and the Carthaginian priestesses who ran oracles, and the Sibyls, and every kind of feminine spiritual authority they were very much opposed to and did the best they could to deprive them of their rights.
Was it women's spirituality that you think they objected to, or the practice of paganism?
I think they equated goddess worship with paganism, which indeed it largely was, because most of the pagans had a supreme being who was female rather than male. The mother of the world, the mother began everything. All the gods were born of this great mother figure.
Do you think that the hostility toward paganism had to do with the fact that it revolved around goddess worship?
Definitely.
What evidence is there of that?
There is much evidence, both in history and in mythology, and in the writings of the church fathers themselves, who are very much opposed to all forms of feminine spirituality, or, well, as we see in St. Paul, women are not allowed to preach or teach in church. They should be quiet and listen only to their husbands. There were a number of early Christian sects which gave some kind of authority to a feminine figure, notably Sophia, who was the Gnostic great goddess. They were suppressed. They were declared heretical. There were early Christian sects up to the 5th century that worshipped Mary as a full-fledged goddess with divinity of her own. They were suppressed. There were churches which originally had priestesses serving the cult of Mary. They were suppressed. Everywhere the feminine principle cropped up, it seemed, the church tried to repress it.
You suggest even that the insistence on Mary's non-divinity is an example of that suppression.
I think very much so. Most scholars believe that Mary was not a real person, but rather an adaptation of the older Middle Eastern goddess known as Mari, M-A-R-I, a form of Ishtar, or of Astarte, or of Anath. All of these were worshipped in the Jerusalem temple from a very early time. And there was a time when this goddess was considered the spouse of God in the Jerusalem temple.
My guest is Barbara Walker, if you're just joining us, and we're discussing the subject of her new book, The Woman's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets. You write that there are a lot of word derivations that words that we use now that are derived from paganism. Maybe we can go over some of those. Where do we start? Where does the word pagan come from, first of all?
Pagan is from the Latin pagani, which means a country dweller. And the reason the pagans were called pagans was because the people outside of the cities in the early Middle Ages were the ones who clung to the old religion and insisted on worshiping the Great Mother rather than the new Christian God. So, of course, country dweller became a more or less pejorative term, as we would say, hick. A pagan was a hick, somebody who clung to the old ways and was not progressive.
You say that a lot of pejorative words now that are used to describe women have their roots in paganism.
Very much so. Take the word hussy, which now means a rather loose woman. In its original language, which was Old Norse, it meant the keeper of the house, the owner of the house being hus. And her husband, was the one who was bonded to the house as a kind of steward. The husbands were those who helped out and were allowed to take part in the property ownership only as long as they were married to the hussy, the one who owned the house. And, of course, bridegroom is another way of saying the same thing. It literally means the bride's servant. The husbandry is another modern derivation, and it still means farm work, which is what it meant back then. The man earned his right to live in his wife's house by doing the farm work.
In our culture, it's traditional for children to bear the name of the father, though a lot of families have reevaluated that. How did the matrilineal system work in terms of the name being passed on and the power structure within the extended family?
It was very much the same in reverse. The matrilineal system recognized what they called blood relationships only, and blood meant mother blood. They believed that children were literally formed out of the blood of the womb, which was related to the moon. Obviously, women's menstrual cycles were related to the phases of the moon. And the moon, who was often given the title of the goddess, the moon gave the blood that made women's children. So, of course, all descent came through the mother, through the blood. The forebears, name forebears, is forebearers originally. when we speak of descent, they originally meant descent from the womb. The clan system ran from mother to daughter always, and the only important male relative was the maternal uncle, who was related through the mother's bloodline, of course. As a matter of fact, when the early missionaries went to Ireland and Scotland and British Isles, they were forced to call Christ our sister's son, because sister's son was the only male relationship that the people recognized as being a holy one, a sacred one. And when they spoke of fatherhood, the early missionaries, in their writing, they said that the pagans in Ireland and Scotland made no recognition of fathers, and this was a great sin. And it was a good thing that Christianity was coming into the land to correct this great sin.
Do you think that there was so little recognition of fathers because not much was known about how physiologically and biologically how children were made and what the man's role is?
Very definitely. I think that this was not recognized until comparatively late in history. There is no question that with a freer marital structure or extramarital structure, there would not be any recognition of fatherhood. It is, after all, not very apparent.
Was there that kind of structure? Was there open marriages, so to speak,
yes,
among pagans?
Yes, I think for quite a long while. Marriages tended to be rather loose and rather ephemeral and easily dissolved. And we see this in the divorce laws applying to very early cultures. In Arabia, where it is now possible for men, for Islamic men to divorce their wives by saying, "I divorce thee," three times, it used to be equally easy the other way around for the women. Women owned the tents in the desert-dwelling tribes, and if a woman wished to cast off her husband, all she had to do was turn her tent around to face the other direction. And then he understood that he was forbidden to enter her tent anymore. We have today a curious relic of this custom in the Jewish marriage ceremony, where the couple stand under a canopy known as the huppah, or tent. And this is all that's left of the woman's tent, the marriage ceremony having been, in effect, a permission for the man to enter her tent.
There are some religions that view sexuality as a form of holy communion, and other religions that view sexuality as something that's, unclean and to be performed only for the purposes of procreation, or else it would be sinful. Some people say that if you look at a religion's attitude toward sex, you'll understand something about its attitude toward women. Do you think that that's true?
Yes, I do. I believe that men find it very difficult to think of women and sex as two separate and different things, after all. Those religions which admired or adored sexuality as a kind of holy communion with the maternal spirit or with the feminine spirit still exist in various parts of the world, but of course Christianity was bitterly opposed to this view, even though there were a few early Christian sects which were influenced by it. On the whole, Christianity has been extremely ascetic and extremely anti-female and anti-sexual. Throughout most of the Christian centuries, the church taught that the only reason married couples should have sex at all was for procreating children, and that women never, never should be allowed to enjoy themselves in sex.
There are some pagan religions where sex was part of certain rituals.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit, how sex was seen in those paganist religions, and was it a form of holy communion? Was it looked at that way?
Yes, very much so. The men who wished to commune with the spirit of the goddess did it through a real woman, one way or another, a wife, a priestess, a holy harlot, a Shakti, as they called her in the Far East. She was adored for her ability to commune with the feminine spirit of the cosmos. And men, in order to make a connection, literally speaking, with the cosmic female, had to do it through a mortal female. So we had, throughout all of paganism, everywhere in the ancient world, there were priestesses whose business it was to help men to commune with the Great Mother through various kinds of sexual techniques.
Was anything known about birth control?
Yes. In the Greco-Roman world, there were quite a few things known about birth control. Women used all kinds of techniques, vaginal sponges being one of the earliest and handiest, I suppose.
So the priestesses who were sexually having communion with men weren't getting pregnant all the time?
They were, sometimes. Very often their titles gave them the right to have holy children. They were called the brides of the god. When the god and goddess were worshipped together in the same temple, the children that they produced were called virgin-born sons of God, because they were considered to have been conceived by the deity through these sacred sexual ceremonies.
Is that what you were referring to before when we were talking about Mary, how some people think that she was one of the pagan goddesses?
There are actually non-canonical, but nevertheless Christian scriptures which say so, that she spent some period in her life working as a kadisha, or a temple woman, and that she conceived Jesus at the moment when she was starting to spin the red thread of life within the temple.
What does that mean?
Well, most of the fate goddesses were considered spinners, and the virgin form of the triple goddess was the one who spun the thread. The mother form, who was the intermediate one, measured the thread. In the Greek, she was known as the Moira, or the Lachesis, the measurer. And then there was a third one, the crone, who cut the thread and decided when a person would die. So we have this original trinity of virgin, mother, crone, which a number of scholars have talked about. Robert Graves, particularly, has emphasized this trinitarian nature of the goddess.
There's also a lot of very explicit goddess imagery in sculpture.
Yes.
And you write about one in Ireland called the Sheilinigig.
Right.
Would you describe that?
These are stone sculptures which have been found in Irish churches dating before the 16th century. A lot of them have been removed since the 19th century, when it was pointed out to the church fathers that they were pornographic, or what people considered pornographic. They're very old. They consist of women, naked women, squatting with their knees apart, displaying their genital area where there was a double-pointed oval shape, which is now known as the vesica, or vesica piscis, a vessel of the fish. And the same squatting figures occur in the Far East, in India, where there are temples showing Kali, or the Shakti, Kali Shakti, at the door also, displaying her genitals in the same manner. And just as Christians now walking into a church would touch the font and make the sign of the cross or something like that, people entering the tantric temples would touch what they call the yoni, the vulva of the goddess, to bless themselves. Curiously, the same name given to the goddess in the Far East also occurs among the ancient Irish. She is called the Caelic, which is very, very close to Kali, almost pronounced the same way.
What are the origins of the Sheilinigig, the sculpture that you were describing a moment ago?
I think they are originally Aryan, Indo-European. I think they were probably brought to the British Isles very, very long ago from the Indo-European migrants who came westward from northern India.
Are there any left now standing over churches?
I think so. I have never seen any with my own eyes, but I've seen pictures of them. There are some, and there have been a number of examples dug up from places where they were buried near the church, where they were hacked out of the stonework.
My guest is Barbara Walker, and she's from New Jersey and has written a new encyclopedia that's called the Women's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets. There are a lot of women now who are practicing what's sometimes called neo-paganism, also called women's spirituality, and the women I'm thinking of have been trying to use goddess worship again and to bring back some of the values of goddess worship from pagan times into modern times. What do you think of these different groups of women who are doing that? And I say different groups because it's not like it's one mass religion. There's a lot of different approaches taken in different regions and by women with different interests.
I think women find it an empowering symbol. I think it appeals to many women who perhaps have been raised in a Judeo-Christian background and have felt oppressed by the idea of a God who cursed them and a God who would not permit them to have any spiritual authority. And I think it helps women to feel freer in their own minds and better able to develop their own ideas and their own feelings.
Do you think that there's any excessive romanticism on their part in romanticizing what the past was like?
It could be, but that's what religions are, after all. What is a religion but a romanticized projection of what we ourselves think and feel?
If feminists are striving for a state of equality between the sexes, do you think at this point it brings women closer to that equality to go back to a period of religion in which everything now is transposed? Instead of men being in the position of power, women were in the position of power, but it was still that power hierarchy that was enforced within the family and within religion.
My impression has been, now of course I could be wrong, but my impression has been from my sources that it was not really so much a power hierarchy as men have made of it. I have the distinct feeling that women were more benevolent in their relationships with their subordinates, just as mothers are fundamentally benevolent toward their children. I have the feeling that they did not try to control or oppress as much as men have done historically.
Do you practice any form of women's spirituality?
Personally, I don't, no.
How come? I'm just curious that, you know, with all the research that you've done, probably a lot of women who do practice that will be reading your book and looking for more information about the past, yet you, with all that information, remain more of a historian of it than someone who practices.
Yes, I'm a scholar rather than a mystic, and I think that one can study. In fact, I have really felt driven to study this subject. Probably if I were a mystic, I would say that I was driven by an external force. But I think the force has been internal rather than external. And indeed, I think that most people, no matter what religion they practice or how they practice it, are doing it more from internal drives rather than external ones.
Well, that leads me to another point that you make in the book, which is that atheism is considered to be a very unspiritual state in our culture, but you say that in certain Eastern cultures, atheism is considered just another route to the same end and not necessarily any less profound than practicing a religion.
Yes, there are some Eastern sages who have even held that atheism is more religious than practicing a specific cult. They say that people who profess one god or another are people who tend to put each other down, to hate and fear and kill each other, whereas religion, they say, is kindness and nothing more. And if you practice kindness, you are practicing the true religion. And of course, an atheist can practice kindness.
Are you interested in finding out about all the different roads that people have taken instead of going on one specific road?
Of course. I think it was my curiosity that led me to this subject in the first place. In my own religious training, I never received anything like satisfactory answers to my questions.
Look, what kind of questions did you have?
Well, when I was a small child and went to Sunday school, it made me wonder a good deal why this loving, fatherly God should have insisted upon the killing of his own son. I mean, it seemed to me that one would not entirely trust a father who treated a child this way. Neither could one trust a God who pretended to love all of his children and commanded one group of his children to massacre other groups of his children, as he did in the Old Testament. He made me decidedly uneasy, this God, and I had a hard time figuring out why people thought him worth adoring.
What religion were you brought up in?
Episcopalian.
Did you officially leave the church at some point?
Not officially. I just didn't care very much for it one way or the other.
Was anyone close to you appalled when they realized not only weren't you practicing your religion, but you were studying up on paganism and goddess worship?
I wasn't studying up on paganism and goddess worship that long ago. I was studying up on the origins of religious ideas. And of course, in those times, there wasn't much available in the way of literature. I think the first book I encountered that really opened my mind was The Golden Bough, Sir James Frazer's Golden Bough, which was written in 1922. But when I really started bearing down on this research, there was not anything like as much available as there is now.
So where did you go? I know you've been in touch with a lot of scholars, but did you go back to original texts for your research?
Yes, some. I also read a great many of the very early scholars who had just begun to make a dent in this subject. Robert Graves, Robert Briffault, Frazer. There were, you know, quite a few that had tried, but they hadn't somehow hung it all together yet. That took a while.
Will you be doing more in this area?
I think so. It's certainly a rich field for study.
You have another book in the works, and that's about tarot cards.
Yes. It's called The Secrets of the Tarot, and it will be published in October by Harper and Row.
Now, why are you interested in that? A lot of us are mostly familiar with tarot cards from people who come around in restaurants and ask if they can do a reading for you.
Yes. This is not one of those books that tells you how to tell fortunes. I'm interested in finding out what the tarot meant when it first appeared in Europe in the 13th century, and who brought it there, and why it was brought, and why people responded to it and thought it sacred enough to be used as a means of divination.
Who did develop it?
Apparently, it was brought from the Far East, most people think by the gypsies who were migrating westward from Hindustan, beginning about the 10th century. And in the Far East, sacred scriptures were very often given in the form of packs of cards with pictures on them, rather than texts, because there were not that many people who were literate. And so they taught religious doctrines by means of pictures rather than writing. The books, what they called books, were not bound together in pages like books that we have now. They were stacked together and held by string so that they were like packs of cards. Also, it seems that those who made pilgrimages to the temples in the Far East walked through what they called the sacred picture gallery, where they would encounter pictures of different gods and goddesses as they went along and be instructed each time in some new enlightenment in the doctrines that they were to be learning. Those who could not make the pilgrimage or who could not afford to often were given packs of cards with the same pictures on them so that they could learn from the card pictures rather than from the pictures in the temple. And I think that cards evolved in these ways so that originally they were considered sacred and they were not used for divination until this concept of the sacredness of the cards had fairly well disseminated.
What are your opinions of people who still use the tarot for divination now?
It depends on how they use it. Some are frankly frauds and using it only to make money from the gullible. Some people use them privately for meditation, and it seems to help organize one's mind if one has some problem to think about. Some people use it for fun, for social encounters. There are all sorts of ways of dealing with tarot cards.
Do you ever do tarot readings?
Oh, sure. Anybody can do that. I've read so many books on the subject that I have learned how 15 different ways over. And
do you take it seriously? Do you follow?
Not really.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Do our playing cards have any relationship to tarot cards?
Oh, yes, indeed. The four suits of the tarot were the forerunners of the four suits that we now use. The original tarot suits were cups, wands, pentacles, and swords, and they correspond to our hearts, clubs, diamonds, and spades. In addition, the tarot had a fifth suit known as the major arcana or greater secrets, all of which have disappeared from the modern deck except for one, which is the Joker. And the reason they disappeared was because churchmen were very much opposed to them. And of course they had good reasons. They felt that the Trump suit, the major arcana suit, was teaching pagan doctrines, and I think that indeed it was.
We're about out of time, but I have one last question. I know that over 25 years you've been researching religions, but in that time, too, you've written about 10 books on knitting. Is there a connection between the two for you?
I think there is a connection between pattern research and symbolism.
And that's what you've been doing with knitting, is pattern research.
Yes, they're both graphic ways of dealing with concepts, and I think there is definitely a connection.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Now, I've been speaking with Barbara Walker, who has written a new reference book called The Encyclopedia of Women's Myths and Secrets, and it covers many contemporary and historical religions. And it's published by Harper & Row. Her name again, Barbara Walker. The book's name, The Woman's Encyclopedia of Myths and Secrets. It's 24 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY 91 FM. A reminder that at about 3:55, we'll be hearing today's National Press Club address by Minister Louis Farrakhan. Every Monday afternoon at this time, 91 FM arts reporter Julie Burstein reports on the arts. Today, Julie speaks with gallery director Marion Locke about her new talent show.
There are six artists in Marion Locke's 16th annual New Talent exhibit, and they represent very different sensibilities, from Richard Stevens' graceful and mysterious photograms of plants and flowers to Kurt Solmsen's large and powerful landscapes of local urban areas. The front room of the gallery is filled with an installation by Gary Robbins entitled Binna. It took me a few minutes to get up the courage to walk past the fierce and funky figure guarding the entrance and enter the space. Once inside, I was surrounded by large, darkly colorful cutout figures with mythic implications and covered with contemporary hieroglyphics. The walls, floor, and ceiling are painted, lights flash off and on, and eerie sounds and music emanate from a large figure in the corner. The other rooms of the gallery are lined with a series of small collages by John Carlano, clay and acrylic sculptures by Nancy Fried, and surrealistic acrylic paintings by Annabel Meacham. Since she opened her gallery in 1968, Marion Locke has been showing the works of new artists.
I think when I started out, all the shows are new talent for Philadelphia. Basically, it was young people coming out of school. As time went on, I found there were many people who had been out of school or had been painting for a long time, and for lack of places to exhibit in Philadelphia, were in a sense new talent, new to being seen. And I decided that the new talent shows would then represent people who had not been seen in my gallery, at least, and not in the areas particularly. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a mix. At one time, I had a new talent show that had a range of ages from about 18 to 80. And sometimes it's a very local show generally, but sometimes I like to bring people from another area just to establish a relationship or to see the differences, and particularly because I think it's good for all artists to see other art in relation to their own.
How do you look for new talent? Where do you go to look for new people to exhibit?
Way back when I started, I used to ask the artists that were in the gallery with me for suggestions for people to add to the group. And in the beginning, it was possible there were only 4, 6, or 8 people, and they in turn could ask for make one or two suggestions, and so I would end up with probably 10 or 12 or 14. As the group grew, it got more and more difficult to take all of their suggestions. And I remember one year in particular where I asked maybe a dozen of my regular stable, and all of whom were teachers in the various art schools, to make a recommendation. And that was probably one of the most interesting shows and one I learned the most from, because I had maybe 15 or 16 people in that show, all of whom looked so much like the teachers who had recommended them that when people came, they would say, oh, is that so-and-so? And I'd say, no, that's a student. So from then on, I began to not that I didn't like that idea, because I think it's a very healthy thing to take on influence, and it certainly cannot be denied. I began to look around a little bit myself and yet rely on certain teachers that I felt were most important for me to talk to. I find that there are certain teachers who are favorites of the students, talking to the graduating students I learn. So I ask from time to time, I'd ask faculty people and look myself. But as the years went on, the volume of correspondence and slides that I see is immeasurable. I cannot tell you how many hundreds and hundreds of slides I look at till I get very jaded and very weary. And in a sense, this year I tried to stop that because I said I wouldn't look at slides until January just to cut the volume in half. And between January and April or May, when we finally make the decision, you're over inundated. You just can't. I can't tell you. And we finally narrow it down. It's very painful, very difficult to narrow it down. Sometimes you do include a person for political reasons, for social reasons. Sometimes you do it because the person needs it so. You feel it, you're doing maybe you would call that social. Sometimes because they're exciting, and sometimes because it's a perfect mixture. There's no real rule of thumb about how I do it or how I select, but mostly it's just from looking around and trying to get a mix of what's happening in the area.
Have you seen a transition in the sort of work that's been done in the city in the past 15, 16 years?
I have seen particularly a rejection of the young, the artists coming out of school, rejection of what is happening. It's almost two sides of a coin. Rejection of what's happening in the big scene in New York, rejection of the waves, the trends, the isms, returning to a kind of very painterly realism from a large number. And then I see, of course, those who are reflecting what they see in the exhibitions in New York, what they see in the magazines. As a matter of fact, I wish I could pass some kind of a law that young artists should read the articles in magazines and never look at the pictures. But we're too close to New York, and there is such a strong influence. There's much more emphasis, less emphasis on paintings and traditional two-dimensional works. There's more object orientation. There's more installation and site work.
When you work with an artist, how do you work on the price of an object?
Well, that's always been a very difficult question. I try with a young talent, a new talent, to relate their work, show what the prices are in the gallery for artists that are already on their way or semi-established or established. And it's always been a hardship to understand how much time they put in relation to what they're going to get. Inevitably, you'll find they live and work on a substandard level. I'm amazed that we know in our society we have a minimum wage. If you could possibly realize how much time and effort is put into a painting like that, for instance, and that the artist would get less than a domestic or a less so-called minimum wage person. I had an artist, one of the best I know, again, who's established in New York, and he did a show here. It was a beautiful show, and we figured what it cost him to do the show. It took him a year to do and a certain amount of material. We estimated, I think, they made about 49 cents an hour. And this is pretty common. Artists put a great deal more of time into it, and it seems hard. So I always try with a young artist, of course, I always do, have a lower commission level for their first show, and then gradually work up with them. The gallery, of course, has to have a percentage in order to exist, as you know. And then I think they have to grow into their own understanding of what the marketplace is about. They must understand that people will say, well, why? Why do you think that is worth $1,000 or $500 or $200 or whatever? You have to really say, have something, some credibility. They have to want it enough to say, like, my theory is that, you know, it gives more pleasure and more, it has more utilitarian value. That picture is going to be here long after I am and for many, many years. I still have the first painting that I bought in 1934. And it's still fine. It still gives me pleasure every single day. It gives me pride and pleasure, and I get an experience from it that I can't translate in any other thing. Now, you tell me where for 50 years something will, your furniture, your clothes, whatever you have, will have outlived their beauty or useless or something in 50 years, and it's the only lasting thing I know. And so I try to tell that to the buyer of a new artist. Generally speaking, the artist himself has to realize that there is a level that the people who are looking, the young artists, are not willing to pay over a certain amount for their education, which is continuing. This is what the emerging artist has to also know, that your education continues through several years into the future after you've been out of school. Yeah. So I make myself clear, it's a very difficult subject.
Marion Locke's gallery is located at 1524 Walnut Street, and the New Talent Show runs until August 31st. She also runs a gallery at 122 Arch Street in Philadelphia, where there's an exhibit of the work of two artists who were in her New Talent Show last year, Lanny Bergner and Joyce Phillip. There's also a New Talent Show at Suzanne Gross Gallery at 1726 Sansom Street. There's sculpture, prints, and paintings in this exhibit by new area artists. I'm Julie Burstein.
Julie Burstein reports on the arts every Monday afternoon at this time. Funds for her reports are made possible through grants from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Mellon Bank. It's 14 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air on WHYY 91 FM. Coming up in about 7 or 8 minutes, we'll be hearing from Minister Louis Farrakhan, and we'll be featuring his address earlier today before the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. First, let's listen to a selection from the latest Sonny Rollins album. This is a calypso called Meva Meva.
Thank you.
Sonny Rollins from his latest album, Sunny Days and Starry Nights. That was a calypso titled Meva Meva. It's 9 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Earlier today in Washington, D.C., Minister Louis Farrakhan addressed the National Press Club. Coming up, we're going to hear his address and the question and answer period which followed, tape delayed from National Public Radio.
Support for this program comes from NPR member stations and the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, for coverage of the Olympics, the Times Mirror Company, serving the public through newspapers, magazines, books, cable, and television. Election coverage by AT&T, providing telephones...